Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nyga. Glad to have you with us on, if you're listening in real time, this Monday afternoon, the start of an awfully big week here in Georgia. Of course, primary elections start tomorrow, 7 a.m. The polls will open statewide. And on today's show, we're going to dig down into some of the most, the highest profile races. I don't want to say important. They're all important to one extent or another, but the highest profile races. Before we do that and introduce the panel, a couple of quick notes. A reminder, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Go to the GPB news page on Facebook, and you'll find us there. And leave your comments if you do that. We try to read some of them out during the course of the show. You can also leave comments on Twitter at PoliticsGPB. So that's how you communicate with us when you're not in the same room as we are. But on June 7th, Jim Galloway and I will be traveling down to Columbus, Georgia, with our producer, Tom Faust. And I imagine Tyler Morris, our engineer, will be coming down there with us, too. We're going to do the show live in front of an audience at the River Center in Columbus. And we're excited about that. And if you want to join us, just go to gpb.org/community. You'll see all the information. And then just register. It's free, but, you know, we want to make sure you have a seat. So go ahead and register to join us in Columbus, Georgia, on Thursday evening, June 7th. Galloway, that's going to be fun going down to Columbus.
Yeah, that's a nice venue that you got.
Yeah, it's a beautiful venue. We owe it to Mayor Teresa Tomlinson for helping us out, a frequent panelist on the show. That is Jim Galloway. He's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Wednesdays and Sundays are the days his column appears in the paper. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, part of myajc.com. Are you already working on a Wednesday column?
Oh, yeah.
Of course you are. And you can't tell people the dilemma you have.
Oh, okay. All right. Here's your journalistic dilemma. They need a Wednesday column out of me on Tuesday, Election Day, at 5 o'clock. So what you got to zig when everybody else zags, and that works out. That works out. I've got a little piece in the work, piece in the works on David Scott. We talked about him and that meltdown that he had last week over the farm bill.
Yeah, in the farm bill, we played portion of that on Friday. He's very upset because he thinks that the historically black land grant colleges are not getting a chunk of money, some $90+ million that he believes the farm bill included for them, although the Ag Committee says
that he thought he had bargained for.
Right. And so we'll watch how that unfolds. So we'll read your column, too. Julianne Thompson is back with us today. She's a Republican consultant. She is has worked in the trenches of state party politics for an awfully long time. Can we tell people that you came in here today after a really rough day yesterday?
Yes. I had an emergency root canal yesterday. My dentist came in especially for me on the Sunday morning. But he is a rock star, and thankfully I have zero pain.
Good. Glad to hear that.
You're referring to a root canal, not the debates yesterday.
I think some people would have thought the debates were root canals yesterday, too. That's Heath Garrett. Of course, he is a Republican consultant and his best-known client and friend over the years, U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacs. And it's Monday. We're always glad to have you with us on Mondays, Heath.
It's great to be here, Bill, on an exciting day.
And we're inviting, and we have in here, I'm really happy about this, first time on the Political Rewind panel, Cesar Mitchell, former president of the Atlanta City Council, former candidate for mayor of Atlanta. Cesar, it's really wonderful to have you here.
It's really great to be here with all of you. I mean, I hate I couldn't come earlier, and I really can't, you know, stake the ground of being a recent dental patient. I mean, God, Sunday? Sunday, well, root canal? What could be worse?
You know, you ran for mayor, of course, in this last election cycle. Do you do it? You know, Al Gore, after losing in 2008, a great line that he used when he opened his speeches. He would say, I'm Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States. You ever use that one?
No, I'm Caesar, Uber driver of 3 kids.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's get right into the conversation. Jim, let me start with you. Let's start with the Democrats, because there's been an interesting breaking news story, breaking development. We've got Stacey Abrams, of course, against Stacey Evans. the outcome of that race tomorrow will decide who the Democrat is, since there's only two of them running.
Right, right. And I think over the weekend, Stacey Abrams got Bernie Sanders' endorsement. Today, we've just got up on the Political Insider blog that Hillary Clinton has cut a robocall for Stacey Abrams, which means she's got pretty much the entire national Democratic front on her side going into this race. It's going to be very, very tough for Stacey Evans, I think, to pull this one out.
Well, okay, so let's talk about that. What is the value of an endorsement from Hillary Clinton, Caesar?
Well, first of all, Hillary Clinton is well-liked. She did well in the state of Georgia. She is, of course, a woman who has succeeded, and in many ways, people can identify with her success story, particularly if you're a woman. For Stacey Abrams to be able to get Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton's endorsement really is a very, very strong statement. And while voters still have to make their decision on the ground here in the state of Georgia on Tuesday, I think you can't ignore that if you are in the electorate.
Julianne, it's an interesting way to end this campaign because, as we've seen throughout the Abrams-Evans battle, Abrams has been the favorite of many national Democrats. Now she got Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, but she had Cory Booker in her camp. Kamala Harris was in her camp. And she's raised a lot of money from around the country. And what we've said here over and over again is one of the things she has in her favor is there's history to be made here. How important has all of that national support for her been?
I think it's extremely important and impressive, actually. I agree with Jim. It's going to be hard at this point for Stacey Evans to pull this off. But I will say this. They're both extremely strong candidates, especially in the Democratic primary. In the general election, I do feel that Stacey Evans is probably a more broad-based candidate that would have more broad-based support. I've heard a lot of Republicans stating, depending on who comes out of the Republican primary, that some of them might actually consider to cross over to vote for Stacey Evans. So, you know, I it's up in the air. We'll see.
You know, Heath, do voters in primaries typically make decisions, in a race of this sort, thinking about what the next step of the race will be? You know, that what Julianne is saying is, of course, right, interesting. Maybe Evans would be the stronger general election candidate. But people, do they vote that way?
I think there's a small percentage in a primary who do, but it's a small percentage, right? At least 80% of the voters are going to vote for the candidate that they either have an emotional attachment to or some kind of policy attachment to in these cases. And I do think this is big news for Stacey Abrams. It gives the symbolism of unifying the Democratic Party. I do think, unlike other cases, having a Hillary Clinton and a Bernie Sanders with the Act Blue activism that's out there is a big momentum boost for her going in, and it's gonna be interesting. It does also show us that Stacey Abrams, if she were to come out of the nominee, and it looks like to me she may, that this is going to be a nationalized race where there's going to be national Democratic money and focus on the state of Georgia. And it's something that we as Republicans had better pay attention to and not take for granted a state like Georgia, because with this kind of firepower, it will make a difference.
Yeah, you can use electability as an issue, and it's been used in Democratic primaries before. And I'm thinking of Jim Martin versus Vernon Jones in the attempt to unseat Saxby Chambliss. That was 2008. But it took a lot of doing by a lot of high profile African Americans to say Vernon Jones is not your guy. Vote for Jim Martin, and it took a lot to get that done. And I don't see that being done here.
Agree.
Let me throw this out. And if you don't mind, Caesar, I'll ask you first. By the way, have you picked a candidate in the Democratic? Have you endorsed?
I have not publicly endorsed anyone yet.
All right. Well, yes. Caesar, the polls open in about 17 hours.
Timing's everything.
All right. Do you plan to endorse?
At some point I may.
Did you want to do it before the hour is up on Political Rewind?
No.
All right. So let me throw out an observation and see how you all react to it. Watching the Democratic debate, which Channel 2 and the AJC held yesterday, it reminded me, and maybe this is true for Abrams too, but it seems most that I can think about it most clearly with Evans. The focus of this campaign, her campaign, has been almost entirely on reviving the Hope Scholarship, making it available as a needs-based program. And in addition to the positive spin on that, she's also used it to attack, of course, her opponent, Stacey Abrams, saying that Abrams made a deal with the Republicans in the House to cut back on the spending. Can you run a race that narrowly and expect to win?
No. When you think about it, the Hope Scholarship still exists. There are students that are still going to college on the Hope Scholarship, and there's no news release that says the Hope Scholarship is about to come to an end. However, I will say that Stacey Evans was pretty smart in choosing that as an issue. And the reason I say that is because I think that issue allows her to define herself on a personal level.
Was a poor girl growing up in trailer camps in North Georgia.
In Ringgold, Georgia. Yeah. And she went all the way through public school, went to the state university for both undergrad and for law school. And so the Hope Scholarship, she kind of drapes that around her. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps her. It helps define her. It helps her tell her story. And in a race where we can't quite figure out whether or not it's going to be about personality or policy, that might help her. However, I don't think that attacking Stacey Abrams on Hope Scholarship has negatively defined Stacey Abrams, again, because of the first thing I said. The Hope Scholarship still exists, and Abrams can point to statistics that shows that she actually provided an opportunity for more students to have access to hope through different kinds of programs.
So let's just, Julianne, let's just hypothetically say maybe Stacey Evans does pull this out tomorrow. I mean, we got to be very careful here. She is a good, smart candidate. She's got the backing of some significant Democratic leaders in the state. There have been a lot of undecided voters. We haven't seen a poll since the end of last week, but there apparently are a lot of undecided Democrats. So I'm not trying to count her out by any means. So what happens if she wins and goes on to the general election? Can you continue running a campaign around the Hope Scholarship, or do you have to come up with some other important issues that you think will resonate?
Well, I absolutely agree with Caesar. I don't think you can just run on one issue. But I also agree that it has allowed her to become someone that has, like I said before, a broad-based appeal. Everyone relates to Stacey Evans on either side of the aisle. And she has a compelling story. And I honestly, as a Republican, she's a frightening candidate in the general election. And she comes across as being very kind and, like I said, relatable. So, no, she would have to have some other issues as well. But I think what is damaging to Stacey Abrams in the general election is that many of her issues have come across so far to the left, which I know that you have to run in the primary, just like Republicans have to run far to the right in the primary, that I'm not sure that she can pivot to the center as she would need to as much as Stacey Evans could.
Okay.
I think that's going to be the big story, right? Stacey Evans was not able to identify herself as progressive enough for the Democratic primary because she had one issue, and it's a good issue, but it's much more of a centrist issue and a general election issue. I think at the end of the day, you've got to define yourself as a true progressive, and I think that's why you see these national folks over there in order to win the Democratic primary in Georgia.
Yeah, but you know, truthfully, there's not that much difference policy-wise between these two.
Yeah, they're pretty close. Yeah,
they're awfully close.
On the broader spectrum, Stacey Evans didn't define herself as mm-hmm. anything but right, to the average right. voter, right?
And the average voter doesn't do their political research. They go by the commercials that they see on television. They just don't have time to do that.
Absolutely. And really, what's really going on in the Democratic Party is really this is in many ways a test case. Almost the question's been called on what type of campaign do Democrats need to run to win in Georgia? Is it one that stays in the center and tries to attract,
the old middle yellow class, dog Democrat coalition?
Exactly. Middle class white people who are from the suburbs, who are moderate Democrats, maybe leaning a little right, but will vote Democrat, versus really going after a low propensity voter who may not have been, you know, registered before. Stacey Abrams has hung her hat on that approach. And that is, I'm going to register hundreds of thousands of voters who haven't been registered or engaged before.
And I'll tell you, even if Stacey Abrams wins tomorrow, that question still won't be answered.
No, it will. You're right. It won't be answered. But again, the question becomes, if you're the nominee from the party.
Yeah, they'll be committed to it.
You'll be committed to it. But then I guess what you got to ask is, if you're Abrams and you're the nominee, can you take any energy you get from bringing these new voters to the poll and then go back to the center and pull voters from middle and center?
What, right? Cesar, you just made the case for why the national media is paying so much attention to the Georgia Democratic gubernatorial race. It is a test case for the entire country in many ways, and there have been lots and lots of articles in major national newspapers on this. Last quick note that I found kind of amusing in a way, Jim, is here's Stacey Evans running a campaign hoping she can revive what used to be the Democratic road to victory, those yellow dog Democrats. So what does she do? Maybe not intentionally, but she essentially takes from the Zell Miller playbook back in 1990. You fully embrace hope and the idea of getting kids free education. And there's a yellow dog Democrat at his best.
And Zell brought us the lottery. Stacey Evans has kind of said
casinos.
She's okay with casinos.
Mm-hmm. All right. By the way, Abrams seems to be leaning toward casinos. We'll see if she wants to embrace it more fully. All right, let's do this. There are some developments we want to talk about in the Republican race for governor, and we have a lot more on the ballot that we want to talk about. But let's get a break out of the way and come back with more on Political Rewind.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Julianne Thompson, Heath Garrett, Jim Galloway, and we welcome to the panel Cesar Mitchell, former president of the Atlanta City Council. As I've said, Cesar, we're so glad to have you here. Remember, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Go to the GPB news page on Facebook, and you'll find us there. And tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Jim, you had a really interesting item as we turn to the Republican race, where we still have five, you know, the Democrats are so easy. Two candidates, a winner is emerging tomorrow. We got five in the Republican contest. But you had an item today that points to what might happen, assuming there is a runoff. First of all, do we think there is going to be a runoff? That Casey Cagle's not going to get over 50?
It's going to be very, very hard for him.
Yeah.
So okay. I think so.
You all agree?
I agree.
Yes.
Okay, nods all around. So what's the item you had today?
Are we talking about the Doug Richards item?
No, I'm talking about the governor's chief of staff.
Oh, my. Oh,
Chris Riley.
So that one. Yes. Okay, so you've got Chris Riley on Saturday puts out a tweet saying, Casey Cagle has been part of the Nathan Deal, David Ralston team. We've lowered taxes. We've fully funded QBE. And yet he says that's not an endorsement. but it raises the possibility that if this thing goes to a runoff, as it's likely, that you could see Nathan Deal jumping in on one side or another in the race.
Well, and the dynamics that are coming forward, Chris Riley made it very clear maybe 6 months ago and said if anybody is viewed as attacking Nathan Deal's record and denigrating his time as governor, they are going to defend his record and point that out to the voters. And there is a fine line between doing that and endorsing. And what you've seen is the second place candidates, the fight for second place, exist around having to say something negative about the current administration in order to make their point. And so I'm not surprised that Chris is coming off the sidelines and defending the administration and all that they have done. Whoever gets into that runoff has a very tough choice. They're going to want to attack the record of the lieutenant governor, which is very similar to the record of the sitting governor, and that gives them a very difficult choice in the primary runoff.
But let's go back to this notion that this isn't an endorsement. Okay, we have to take Chris Riley at his word. Right. He says it isn't.
So far, it's not, you know.
Pretty close.
Who's endorsement, though?
Is it Chris's? He does have his own personality.
Does Chris Riley often get out front on an issue without the governor's knowing about it and signing off on it?
Not to my knowledge. I'm not going to assign that to Chris. But I think it's interesting. This was the first time in a debate where everybody seemed to have attacked Governor Deal at some point in time in the debate other than Casey Cagle. So it was a unique opportunity, and we saw it be pretty swift and pretty firm.
Julianne, what do you make? How would you assess the way this Republican primary has played out?
Speaking about the runoff, it all boils down to who gets their base out. It all boils down to turnout. And so far, it's been pretty dismal. And if it's even worse in the runoff, which it usually is, traditionally, less people show up to vote in the runoff, more often than not, it is the very conservative base that will show up and vote in a runoff no matter how bad the weather is, no matter what. So Chris Riley's quote-unquote non-endorsement could go either way, depending on who shows up. And I think that if he continues to appear to be supporting Cagle and, you know, everyone else in the Republican Party coalesces behind what they consider to be a more conservative alternative to Cagle, then it could go in the direction of that candidate.
So, Caesar, what I hear Julianne saying is, if you were really angry that Governor Deal vetoed religious liberty, if you were really angry that Governor Deal vetoed campus carry the first time around, and you're motivated to go to the polls, the fact that it sounds a little bit like the Deal office is supporting Cagle might give you good reason to want to go out and vote for another one of the candidates aside from Cagle.
Yeah, I guess so, but maybe I can't see clearly on this as a Democrat, to be candid with you, because Deal, quite frankly, has been, in the eyes of many Democrats, a really good governor. Balanced, conservative, but very much balanced. But I can see that line of thinking and how that might impact someone supporting Cagle's opponent in the runoff.
Yeah, to Heath's point, what I'm saying that could develop is, okay, let's give Casey Cagle a berth in the runoff.
Right.
All right.
Around 40%.
Okay. Let's give David Schaefer a berth in the run for lieutenant governor. Right. He's the Senate pro tem. He's one of the longer serving members of the Senate. Schaefer has been attacked by Jeff Duncan. He's one of the other two Republicans in that contest as kind of being a member of the swamp, the so-called Atlanta swamp in the state capitol.
That's right.
Okay, so if you get a Hunter Hill or a Brian Kemp in that the gubernatorial race, then you've got two candidates there who are going to be going after the establishment. I mean, that's their only choice in order to get into the office. And they will be painting both David Schaefer and Casey Cagle as members of that establishment.
Well, there's a big difference between Brian Kemp and Hunter Hill. I mean, Brian Kemp may want to paint Casey Cagle as establishment.
It'll be harder.
But
it'll be harder.
Himself has harder been elected for him, official for a long period of time. But you're exactly right. If it's Jeff Duncan for lieutenant governor and a Hunter Hill, it's going to be a total anti-establishment. However, don't forget, right behind Donald Trump in the Republican primary in Georgia, as far as most popular people, are Nathan Deal and Johnny Isaacs. And they are in the 80s in approval ratings in the Republican primary, even in a low voter turnout environment. So I do think there's some real dynamics here where you can go so far with the anti-establishment, but these voters are a little bit more sophisticated about that than we tend to think they are.
I do not think that you can categorize Casey Cagle and David Schaefer in the same column. When it comes to the Republican base and a lot of the anti-establishment, pro-Trump Republican base, they've coalesced behind Schaefer. But they haven't coalesced behind Cagle. So I think those are those two races are apples and oranges.
So let's Jim, you started us down this road, and I think it's a good one. We assume Cagle is in the runoff, assuming there is one. There was a lot big group of undecideds there. You never know, but assuming that he doesn't get to the threshold, Brian Kemp's the one who's had some real energy behind his campaign. However angry liberals might have been about his gun commercial and then his immigration pickup truck commercial, they seem to have excited voters to the right.
Yeah, he's been able to do something that Hunter Hill hasn't been able to, and that is expand his TV ad campaign beyond the biographical, and to really address some of those visceral issues that Republicans are interested in, like guns. Like immigration.
So, Heath, if you're a consultant to Casey Cagle in a runoff, and you're facing a Brian Kemp who's proud to say, and yes, I just said that, makes, you know, what he thinks of as bold statements that are shocking to some voters, what's your advice? Do you stay the course? Do you have to engage with him on that level? What do you do?
You know, Casey's going to have to make the case, so to speak, that he is a principled conservative. But you do not have to match the anti-establishment rhetoric of someone who's moving further and further to the right in order to win the Republican primary and go into the general election in good shape in Georgia yet. And so I think that if you've got a Casey Cagle who's at 40 and a number two candidate like Brian Kemp or a Hunter Hill at 20 or 22, you're able to stay the course on principled conservative. You got to prove you're a fighter, which he did with two things. He did it with the Delta comment, and he did it with an ad where he talked about MS-13 and immigration, and he's now doing it with an ad where he's talking about the issues that matter to Republican primary voters this year. But you've got enough distance to do that. If the second place candidate is within 10 points and you're under 40, you got to start thinking about altering your strategy.
You know, Caesar, it occurs to me that if Casey Cagle, and we're getting way down the road, but that's all right. If Casey Cagle emerges after the runoff as the Republican candidate for governor, he's been a pro-business. Yes, the NRA Delta matter may have hurt him with some business people for a while, but Casey's talking about, you know, economic development. He's taking on some pretty basic middle-of-the-road growth positions on issues. I would think that he doesn't have to pivot very far to get to the center to appeal to voters across the spectrum.
I mean, from my perspective, he's had to pivot a tremendous amount just to get way off to the right. I mean, he's one of the oldest Republicans in the state of Georgia. And so I think for him getting back to the center to some degree won't be as hard. The other question is whether or not with the Republican Party, whether or not you're going to have a scenario where the anti-establishment is not popular. I just don't think the establishment, the Republican establishment right now, being Governor Deal, is seen as unpopular. I think it's popular right now. And so I think if Casey stays in that space, he's fine. And it's just going to boil down to tribalism. I mean, people are going to vote Republican because they're Republican, and folks are going to vote Democrat because they're Democrat. It's going to be a get-out.
All right, we got some Facebook Live comments. Carrie Beth says, far-left voters are mostly in Atlanta. Democrats will have to stay center to win in the general. Todd Cormack says, Republicans are doing their best to alienate anyone who does not drive a truck and talk slower than traffic through Spaghetti Junction. All right, there's the shot about Southerners. We've got that out of the way. Larry Lowe says, I'm trying to figure out, this is a good question, actually, Caesar. I'm trying to figure out what Abrams is so far to the left on. Abortion, Confederate monuments? That's a good question.
I mean, I don't think she's that far to the left. I mean, again, just like you have the Republican candidates who have to say some of these things that feel very much to the right, I don't think as a candidate and certainly as a leader that Stacey Abrams would be far off to the left.
Yeah, policy-wise, I think you're right. In terms of some of her personal situation, I think she's open to an attack, especially during a general election.
What does that mean, Jim?
I think Stacey Evans has not really gone after Stacey Abrams for number one, for having reached an accommodation with the IRS over $50,000
bill,
at the same time that she has loaned her campaign $50,000. She has, you know, she's got a good bit of debt that's being carried. Those are all things that are going to be, those are going to be broadcast during, in September and October in a way that you're not seeing them right now.
Yeah, I think that she is going to be a vulnerable candidate. I'm telling you, the issues that Evans has stayed away from, but we'll watch how that unfolds. Mm-hmm. Let's move on.
Can I follow up on something really quick?
Of course.
To what Caesar said a few minutes ago about Nathan Deal being popular and candidates more to the center being more popular to the general populace, and I agree with that. But what I'm talking about is who shows up for a runoff.
Right.
And when you talk about who shows up to a runoff, it's not the general populace.
In late July. That's right.
It is the very conservative, mostly at this particular time, anti-establishment Republicans. So Casey would have, you know, his challenge would be, and Casey is a conservative, but Casey's challenge would be being more appealing, pivoting further to the right in his advertising and being more appealing to the people who would actually show up to vote in the runoff.
That's a great point.
I think that puts him at risk, too, in the runoff.
Well, and that's right. And it's we all at this table know that, you know, if you can win, if you can make the threshold, get over the top without a runoff, good for you. Because in runoffs, anything can happen, Heath Garrett. Anything.
Particularly in the Wild West of today, independent expenditures, all kinds of new tools to be used. But there is still some science around the fact, right, if the first place candidate's at 40% or above and is winning by 10%, it's very rare that the second place candidate wins.
Right. I think Chuck Bullock would put that at 45%.
And I think it may be 45%, particularly with independent expenditure money. It's changing every election cycle. But if that second place candidate's within 10 points, then it's, you know, Katie bar the door. Yep. It's going to be a real rumble.
Chuck Bullock, by the way, the fabled University of Georgia political science professor who's been following elections for many decades here in Georgia. As we move towards the congressional races that are of particular interest to us, a couple of quick notes about more localized races. Number one, down in the Macon area, down in Houston County, people aren't even, apparently, many voters aren't aware of the fact they got a T-splost on the ballot tomorrow, a $600+ million T-splost that would add a penny sales tax, a penny on the dollar for the 11 counties in Houston and the surrounding, in Houston and the surrounding counties down there. So it's going to be interesting to watch to see whether the folks in Middle Georgia want to support a T-splost. The history of T-splosts has not been particularly positive in this state.
Well, in certain places outside of Metro Atlanta, it's actually done pretty well. I mean, we had about three areas that passed it in
2008.
That's right. Yeah, we had 2011? Three regions in 2012.
Okay.
Who did it in the summertime during a Republican primary, right, and a Democratic primary. And so it's really going to be interesting to see, but they're definitely, the further away you are from Atlanta, actually the better they tend to do. And if you can get the voter mix informed about it, because usually it's much more localized to roads and bridges and potholes and the things that voters are really most interested in paying for.
All right. In Columbus, they've got a mayor's race on because our friend Teresa Tomlinson, who is a regular panelist on this show, is finishing up. She's term limited. She can't run again. So there have been six candidates down there. One of the most interesting is it's a nonpartisan race. Zeph Baker, who's run a number of times before, and in fact, the Ledger Inquirer has actually endorsed him in past races. He has said, Jim, I am not filing my financial disclosure reports because I don't think it's fair to have to tell people the names of those who've contributed to me because I'm afraid they'll be harassed and bullied. So he now owes about $1,200 in fines in that race.
And it's only going to go higher.
How much did he raise? What, $1,500?
How do we know? He won't reveal how much he's raised. We can only hope he's raised more than the fines he's going to have to pay.
He didn't disclose with no names, just numbers?
Nothing.
Just nothing.
So we'll see. The other candidate who seems to be headed toward the possibility of winning is Skip Henderson, who is a longtime city councilor. We'll watch how that race turns out. I'll tell you what, let's get our second break of the show out of the way now. When we come back, We've got two congressional races that are especially interesting to people in this state. We'll talk about those after this.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon has a new collection of essays called Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces. It features a story about taking his 13-year-old son to Paris Fashion Week, which became a viral sensation online, and meditations on the complicated relationships between fathers and children. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Election Day, of course, is tomorrow. And by the way, we are going to have a special edition of Political Rewind on Election Day tomorrow. We'll be with you live at 2 o'clock. We got a great group of people coming in for that. You'll be here. Thank you, Jim, for spending an extra day with us. Ed Lindsay, a longtime Republican legislator and a guy who is in the know about politics. Your colleague, Tamar Hallerman, from the Washington Cox Bureau, or AJC Bureau, is down here covering races.
Yeah,
she'll
be
with us.
Yeah, we've got the 6th and 7th races, or barn burners.
Yeah, and Michael Owens, the Cobb County Democratic Party chair, will be here as well. So please join us at 2 o'clock for our special edition of Political Rewind tomorrow. All right, Jim, the Democrats believe that in the 6th District, Karen Handel, and in the 7th District, Rob Woodall, are two incumbents who can be beaten in the November election.
Right. They're not on the Republican endangered list, but they are on the Democratic targeted list. And I think there's a general consensus that Rob Woodall in the 7th has his district is changing far more rapidly than anybody else's in Georgia, and he's the more vulnerable one.
Yeah, except that the Cook Report keeps putting Handel as more vulnerable than Woodall, which I'm not sure they're right about that.
No, and I don't think so either. And plus, I mean, remember, she's still reaping the benefits of millions of dollars spent in last year's special election as well.
How do we assess this 6th District Democratic race? You've got four candidates. Mm-hmm. Let's just run them down real quickly. I mean, you've got Kevin Abel, who is from South Africa, who's been on TV quite extensively.
A businessman with good connections.
Right. He's been really the hardest on President Trump. Many people have seen the commercials that show the Trump announcement. He's coming down the escalator, and Abel calls him all sorts of names. You've got Bobby Capel, the former TV newsman, who his commercials are being his twin daughters.
Yeah, premature birth.
Premature birth, and he's pointed out that without Obamacare, he doesn't know what might have happened to those children. And then you've got Lucy McBath, who, of course, is a national advocate for gun control. She sadly lost her son in a gun incident and has been involved. And she's got support from a number of national anti-gun organizations. She got a big check, $800,000+ from Everytown USA, I believe. And then you've got Stephen Knight Griffin, who's sort of very smart. He did well in the debate that I moderated here, but he hasn't gotten a lot of traction. So how do we sort this race out?
It's really up in the air. I think the first three candidates that you mentioned, I think it's going to be between them. I think Lucy McBath certainly has some national name recognition. She has a wonderful story to tell, and of course she's been aggressively raising money and getting her name out there. I think it's going to boil down to just who do you know when you go into the booth, and I think that's going to have some impact. And so the person who's gotten on TV and has gotten exposure that way, I think will benefit.
Okay, here's a question for the group, and I've got to phrase it fairly sensitively. But you've got Ms. McBath is an anti-gun violence advocate. Very outspoken. We just had yet another school shooting in Texas on Friday. How does that impact this race?
Yeah, I think it could. If she can make sure that's on the minds of voters when they go in the polls. I mean, we're talking about the Democratic primary, which is, of course, a smaller swath of what the overall district is. But if she can effectively get that on the minds of voters when they're pushing, you know, or hitting who they're going to vote for, if they see her and think about what happened in Texas, I think that might benefit her. But it may not.
You know, the 6th District is the most highly educated and affluent congressional district in the state, if not the South. That's true in the Democratic primary as well as the Republican primary. So I think this is a fascinating primary to watch. I'm going to be looking for whether or not they're able to maintain the enthusiasm that, the Democrats had when the entire country was focused on this congressional district when Karen Handel eventually won it, as opposed to now a normal election cycle. They're not going to be $30, $40 million spent here. Are the Democrats able to motivate folks to come out and vote in this kind of blue wave? And the primary is the first test of that in the suburbs, in an area where Democratic voter registration is up. But the question is, was last year an anomaly, right, an outlier for us, or are they really able to capture enthusiasm? Because you have four excellent candidates in the Democratic primary focusing on issues that matter to Democratic voters. Will they come out in May at the end of school in a district that's traditionally Republican, and then we should be able to extrapolate some things, you know, to the general on that. So I think it's a fascinating test case.
I am really interested in your – you know, one of the things that I wonder about, Jim, is we know that Lucy McBath has this national reputation. I feel – this is just me speculating. I mean – the commercials, the awareness level based on this in this race for me has mostly focused on Capel and Abel, not on McBath. She doesn't feel to me like she's been there throughout this.
You can never discount geography in all this. And Capel is from North Georgia. Abel is from North. I'm not North Georgia. North Fulton. Abel is from North Fulton. McBath is over on the western side of the 6th district in the Marietta area, and that's not the strength of the district. The strength of the district runs up 400, and that's an element of this race.
I think in this race you're going to see just more traditional campaigning. Be the decisive factor, not as much as it was 2 years ago when it was really a tremendous amount of money and a tremendous amount of national recognition. Now you got to get your voters out. You got to make sure they know who you are. And I think that's going to go to the candidate who has the resources to do it and the organization.
So you've got the 6th district where there are four Democrats challenging for the right to face Karen Handel. If that's hard to figure out, Caesar, over in the 7th district, you have 6 Democrats running to face Rob Woodall. Carolyn Bordeaux has had the lion's share of attention. She's a Georgia State professor. She's raised the most money in the contest. But that's interesting because it's the most diverse field of candidates we've ever seen in a Georgia race before.
Well, it's Gwinnett County.
That's exactly right. You've got David Kim, whose family is from Korea. Mm-hmm. He's first-generation America. Ethan Pham was born in Vietnam, comes to the United States. Both have had successful business careers here. That's really an interesting—and then you have other particularly interesting candidates, but that's a fascinating race.
Well, the question is what's happening on the Republican side? You've got, I mean, Congressman Woodall has— A challenger.
Yep.
So what does that really say?
Last name, Hazard, is it?
Shane Hazel.
So what does that really say for the race and really for the district? Back on the Democratic side, I just think, Gwinnett County is a changing county. And I think Gwinnett County is ahead of the rest of the state in terms of its evolution. So what happens there in that race, I think, is going to be indicative of what we're going to see happening over the
next four years. Right next to you. You are sitting next to an expert on Gwinnett County politics.
I live in the 7th district. My husband is chairman of the Georgia Republican Party 7th congressional district. So I know a little bit about this particular issue. Yes, Gwinnett is changing, but the 7th district is not just Gwinnett. It's also Forsyth. And the part you have to look at the part of Gwinnett that is in the 7th district. You have Peachtree Corners, Duluth, Suwanee, Sugar Hill, Buford, and then you have Cumming over in Forsyth County. So you do have a far more conservative part of Gwinnett in the 7th district than you do, say, in the 4th district. The part of Gwinnett is split into three different congressional districts, the 10th, the 7th, and the 4th. And I don't know why the Democratic Party would make the 7th a target. I think Rob Woodall, if Rob Woodall comes out of the primary, which I do believe he will, I believe he's safe.
Well, what do you make of this challenge from the right to Rob Woodall, Julianne? Are you supporting, have you endorsed Woodall in that race?
My husband is chairman of the 7th District, Georgia Republican Party. So we cannot endorse in that race or any other primary. I guess I can, but I'm, you know.
Well, what do you think about the challenge from the right?
I think that Shane has made headway with some of the members of the Gwinnett County Republican Party and some of the members of the Forsyth County Republican Party. But those of us that are so involved in party politics, Heath can tell you this, Caesar can tell you this from the Democratic side. Those of us that are so entrenched in our party politics live in a bubble, and we tend to think that the rest of the county, the rest of the district, the rest of the state feels the same way we do. And we find out when the election comes around, case in point, when the Republican Party coalesced behind Jack Kingston in the runoff against David Perdue, the vast electorate said, no, we're going with Perdue. So you don't know how it's going to go.
Yeah, I will say one thing that this primary, the Republican primary, has done. It has kept Rob Woodall pinned to the right side of the GOP. He hasn't been able to kind of to maneuver so that he's on the outside edge of the Trump circle. He's had to embrace the Trump presidency full throated.
And you make a good point there, Jim. As the suburban and exurban congressional districts do change demographically, Republicans are going to face these challenges from the right in the primary because the grassroots activist is feeling like they're moving more and more to the center, yet that's the worst thing you can do to hold the seat longer term. And all of these seats, like the 7th, they're going to change in 2020 when we get the new census. They're not going to be as Republican if we want to maintain the same number of congressmen. And so it's going to be a really interesting thing to watch in our primary. And what I think we've got to learn from this Democratic primary is Republicans have got to start to look and feel a lot like their districts. And, you know, Gwinnett is changing rapidly, and we're going to have to do a better job of recruiting candidates that look and sound and come from the communities that they represent. Now, Rob's going to do a great job and win, but at a certain point in time, we as a party are going to have to do a better job of appealing.
Caesar, I think what he said is so important. I mean, there may not be too many more elections in Gwinnett County where Republicans can pretty well count on, oh, yeah, we'll win this one.
No, absolutely. I fully agree with Heath. And I think Rob Woodall's saving grace here might be that the Democrats go into a runoff, which will, you know, essentially be debilitating for Democratic opportunity because, of course, the Republican nominee, probably Woodall, will just be able to get out of the gate and run hard and fast and be down the road before the Democrats decide who the nominee is.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Real, because we're running out of time. Very quickly, Republican Lieutenant Governor's race. We mentioned David Schaefer before. Schaefer, you know, he's been in the Senate for a very long time. He's been a leader there for the Republicans. Is he headed for a runoff, do we think? Or there's two other candidates?
Yeah, there's Jeff Duncan, a former House member, played some a professional baseball in the minor leagues.
And
then
Jeffries.
Rick Jeffries, a former state senator. They've both got pretty good constituencies. So I would it's going to be hard for Schaefer to get 50% plus one.
And over on the other side, you've got Sarah Riggs Amico, who a lot of people seem to think is some opportunity should she beat her
that could be, this
rival.
This could be the race of the general election. I think the most interesting race. I think if she makes it out of this primary,
she'll have resources. Of course, she's a woman. I think she's popular. People like her. And it depends on how strong or how weak the Republican nominee is.
All right. Well, we'll watch all of that unfold tomorrow. We don't have a lot of time for this, but I want to at least spend a couple minutes on it because I find this really to be a fascinating case. ACLU Georgia, which has become was moribund for a very long time in Georgia. Then Andrea Young came in, Andrea Young's daughter, and she's really stepped up the pace. They filed suit against the Secretary of State just now. Because the Secretary of State's office kicked off the ballot a young Latina candidate named Maria Palacios. She's lived in Georgia since 2009. She became a citizen a year ago. The Secretary of State's office determined that she does not qualify as a citizen, doesn't meet the 2-year residency citizen requirement to be a candidate. The ACLU argues, no, this isn't formal. This is residency. You establish residency, and, you know, she's been here since 2009. Residency and citizenship are not synonymous.
Well, yeah, here, the interesting thing, and it's an interesting question. Is there such a thing as Georgia citizenship?
Is there a legal definition? And that's what the court will have to take up. But what's interesting about it, Caesar, is here's a Hispanic woman. She was the only Democrat running in the 29th district, which is 60% people of color, is the way the ACLU describes it, 43% who are Hispanic. The race goes to the Republican by default if this ruling stands.
I mean, it's a huge mistake on the part of the Secretary of State. I think I don't think the requirement is Georgia citizenship when you talk about residency. If she was a lawful resident in the state of Georgia, even though she wasn't a citizen and she was going through the process of becoming a citizen, I don't think that should disqualify
her,
quite
frankly. We should say the Georgia Constitution, Heath, does say you have to be a citizen for 2 years. But I don't think it defines what it means to be a citizen. You're the lawyer.
No, it says you have to be a resident for 2 years.
Well, I think the statute's resident. I think the Constitution does imply, it either implies or quotes citizenship. And so the intent would have clearly been that you're talking about somebody who is a citizen of the United States of America. So they may have to go back and correct this. It actually hands a nice issue to some legislators to now campaign on, but fascinating legal.
But I will give ACLU a lot of credit. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of energy there. Andrea Young, she has some crackerjack lawyers and leaders there. Beryl Ellis is there, who's an incredible leader and incredible lawyer as well. So you're going to continue to see ACLU step up on things like this.
Get the last word.
Thank you. As I read the four requirements, you have to be a U.S. citizen, a Georgia citizen for 2 years, making a difference between being a U.S. citizen and a Georgia citizen. And like Jim says, does that mean resident? The other two are 21 years of age and a legal resident of the territory for 1 year. So it's going to boil down to what the courts say the word citizen means.
But from a political point of view, the Republican Secretary of State's office denies a Hispanic woman the right to run in a district that is predominantly minority population. So from
two
a political,
years is not far away.
Right. All right. We are completely out of time for today's show. Caesar, please come back. Caesar Mitchell, we loved having you here today.
I enjoyed it.
Julianne, you know, you have an open door invitation to be here, as does Heath Garrett and Jim Galloway. I'm going to see you again tomorrow for our special edition of Political Rewind. It's election day tomorrow, Jim.
Yeah, no exit polls, though.
No exit polls in Georgia. That's right. That's it for us for today. Thanks for being with us. Polls open at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning across the state of Georgia. If you have not voted early, I encourage you to go out and vote tomorrow. I'm Bill Nigut. See you tomorrow for our special show at 2:00.